Hello, it is Thursday, the 16th of July. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The Bank of Korea raised its base rate for the first time in 3 years and 6 months, from 2.5% to 2.75%. More on that in today's news briefing. In other headlines, the South Korean government announced plans to create a unified military academy by merging the three service academies of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we discuss a recent series of debates hosted by the government regarding South Korea's real estate policies. Plus, we explore an exhibition of artisans in the heart of Seoul's Gangnam District. Korea 24 starts now. The Bank of Korea raised the benchmark interest rate by 25 basis points to 2.75%, the first rate hike in 3.5 years as it seeks to tame inflation amid the protracted crisis surrounding the Iran war. To give us the details of the Central Bank's Monetary Policy Board decision, as well as some of our other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio our KBS World News editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Andrew.
So the central bank has officially begun a tightening cycle in consideration of an economic rebound stemming from the AI-driven semiconductor export boom. Tell us more about the decision, please.
Well, announcing the hike on Thursday, Bank of Korea Governor Shin Yeon-sung cited mounting inflationary pressure amid the AI-driven semiconductor boom, adding that inflation is expected to remain above the target level for an extended period with ongoing risks to financial stability. Despite the protracted instability in the Middle East, the South Korean government raised its growth forecast for this year from 2 to 3% earlier this week, and the central bank is also expected to follow suit in its outlook due next month. Let's listen to what the BOK governor had to say.
금년 성장률 전망치는 지난 5월 전망치 2.6%를
This year's growth rate is expected to significantly surpass the 2.6% forecast made last May. In terms of pricing, the consumer inflation rate increased to 3.2% in June, driven by rising petroleum prices and an acceleration in the prices of agricultural, livestock, and marine products. Meanwhile, the core inflation rate remained unchanged at 2.5% from the previous month.
South Korea's outbound shipments increased by more than 70% last month compared to the same time last year, breaking the $100 billion mark for the first time on the surge in chip demand. The central bank previously increased the key rate from 3.25% to 3.5% in January 2023, followed by four rounds of cuts between October 2024 and May 2025 to support economic growth. The policy board then left the rate steady for at 2.5% for 8 consecutive months, sessions that is, to monitor volatilities at home and abroad.
So the central bank clearly believes it is necessary to maintain a tight policy stance to keep inflation in check.
That's right. With Thursday's rate hike, the rate gap with the U.S. Federal Reserve has narrowed to one percentage point at the upper bound, reducing the incentive for foreign investors to pull capital out of South Korea's financial markets.
In other headlines, controversy has been brewing for some time over the government's blueprint to integrate the Army, Navy, and Air Force academies under one single entity. And it's now official. The government announced it will establish a unified military academy at Jaundae, a compound of military education and training facilities in Daejeon, located in the center of South Korea. Hee-jin, what can you tell us about these plans?
Well, the announcement came during a policy meeting between the government and the ruling Democratic Party at the National Assembly on Thursday, as the Lee Jae-myung administration seeks to boost the joint operational capabilities of the nation's armed forces and to better train young officers for future integrated warfare. The Army, Navy, and Air Force academies will be merged into a single, quote, Armed Forces Academy. Defense Minister An Yu-baek announced the decision after a policy meeting with the DP lawmakers on Thursday. Let's listen to what he had to say.
우리는 최근 사례를 통해서 전쟁 양상이
We need to transform our education system to reflect the changing nature of warfare. Recent events have demonstrated that the character of war is evolving at an unprecedented pace. Modern warfare is entering an era that requires the ability to operate across multiple domains, including space, cyberspace, and the electromagnetic spectrum, moving beyond the traditional boundaries of land, sea, and air forces. As a result, military academy education must also evolve to prepare cadets for future warfare, where the battlefield spans all domains.
The Unified Academy will be established within a military education and training center in Gyeongdae, as you said, located some 20 kilometers northeast of the Gaerongdae complex, which houses the joint central commands for the Army, Navy, and Air Force.
Now, the Integrated Military College is expected to launch as early as 2028 on the Korea Military Academy campus, which currently trains Army cadets and will eventually be relocated to a new Gyeongdae campus in 2032.
That's right. First and second year of students will receive comprehensive education covering artificial intelligence, land, sea, air, space, and cyber operations, while third and fourth year students will undergo specialized training tailored to their respective military branches.
We've talked about this issue on yesterday's in-depth news analysis segment, but the initiative, which of course was a campaign pledge by President Lee Jae-myung, has been fraught with controversy.
Yes, indeed. There have been concerns both within and outside the military that the move could undermine the specialized expertise and distinct identities of each service branch, ultimately weakening national defense capabilities. An explained that having separate military academies with 700 to 1,000 cadets per branch has led to significant inefficiencies and redundancies. He added that the defense ministry will actively listen to public opinion on the matter with an open mind.
Let's look at some of our other headlines now. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index tumbled more than 6% on Thursday and amid heightened market volatility, slipping back below the 7,000-point mark. Can you give us the closing prices?
Yes, the index closed at 6,820.6, down 463.81 points or 6.37% from the previous session, dipping below the 7,000 mark just one day after regaining the psychological threshold. Investors unloaded bellwether tech shares such as, such as Samsung Electronics, as the Bank of Korea raised its benchmark interest rate to curb inflation. Moreover, renewed tensions between the U.S. and Iran further weighed on investor sentiment. Amid the broad market sell-off, sell-side sidecars were triggered in both the KOSPI and KOSDAQ markets in the morning.
And amid such volatility, the government has been warning against the excitement over leveraged exchange-traded funds, also known as ETFs. Financial regulators have proposed new measures on these vehicles to enhance market stability and protect investors amid recent market volatility. Heejin, can you explain these measures, please?
Well, the Financial Services Commission, the Financial Supervisory Service, and the Korea Exchange announced the measures Thursday, which include raising the minimum deposit for a single stock leveraged ETF to 30 million won, or approximately $20,000 in cash. Currently, the minimum deposit is set at 10 million won in a mix of stocks and cash. Investors will be limited to trading a batch of 20 shares in leveraged ETFs, a change aimed at reducing turnover. Furthermore, the listing of new ETFs tracking Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix will be temporarily suspended amid the ongoing frenzy over artificial intelligence.
That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Heejin.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Anna Yates Liu, assistant professor from the Department of Korean Music at Seoul National University. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The South Korean government on Thursday wrapped up its three-day series of real estate policy debates that brought together experts, officials, and the public to discuss major issues such as housing supply, financial regulations, and taxation. The Ministry of Land, Infrastructure, and Transport held the first debate on Tuesday, followed by the Financial Services Commission on Wednesday, and the Ministry of Finance and Economy on Thursday. This week's forums were held to compile public feedback before the government finalizes its real estate tax reform initiative, which is expected to be announced between late July and early August. To take a closer look at what was discussed during the debates, we have Shim Seo-hyun, an economic policy reporter at News One. Great to have you with us again, Mr. Shim.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Before we look at the real estate policy debates, please give us the details about how housing prices here in Seoul have fared since the government implemented its latest housing market stabilization measures on October 15th last year, please.
So the October measures significantly reduced transactions, but they did not reverse the upward trend in housing prices. According to weekly data from the Korea Real Estate Board, apartment prices rose more than 2% in Seoul during the first 12 weeks following the measures. Prices also increased more than 1% in Gyeonggi Province and about 0.5% in Incheon. In all three areas, the increase was larger than or represented a reversal from the 3 months before the measures. More recently, the average price stated in land transaction permit applications for Seoul apartments rose 2.67% in June from the previous month. That was the largest monthly increase since the October measures. At the same time, the number of applications fell by nearly 11%, showing that prices continued to rise even as transactions declined.
So would it be fair to say the October 15th policy in stabilizing housing prices wasn't that effective? What have the industry and real estate experts have said about this?
Most market participants would probably describe the policy as only very partially effective or largely straight up ineffective. It did curb transactions and made debt financed purchases more difficult. The measures expanded regulated zones and land transaction permit areas across Seoul and parts of Gyeonggi Province, while tightening mortgage limits for expensive homes. Apartment listings in Seoul also fell sharply immediately after the announcement. However, the policy was less successful in stabilizing prices. One reason being restrictions on borrowing have a limited effect on buyers with substantial cash. Another is that tighter regulations caused some owners to withdraw their properties from the market, reducing the number of homes available for sale. Experts have therefore said that landing restrictions alone cannot resolve structural problems, such as limited supply and the concentration of demand in Seoul.
As you just described, the housing prices in the greater Seoul area are not slowing down. The government held a three-day series of real estate policy debates partly to address that, and that wrapped up on Thursday. A lot of attention was paid to today's debate, which centered on real estate taxes, and as the government is set to announce real estate tax reforms as early as late July. Mr. Shim, could you give us details about today's debate and what issues were raised?
So the debate today focused on the two main pillars of real estate taxation, taxes imposed while a property is held, property tax that is, and capital gains tax imposed when it's sold. Regarding property tax, the main question was whether the comprehensive real estate property tax should continue to be based largely on the number of homes owned, or whether it should instead be based on the combined value of those homes. Participants also discussed whether non-resident owners of expensive single homes should face a heavier burden, whether the fair market value ratio should be raised, and whether current deductions for older and long-term homeowners are too generous. Regarding capital gains tax, the biggest issue was the special deduction for long-term property ownership. Many participants said that tax benefits should be linked more closely to actual residents rather than simply to the length of ownership. overall, the three key themes were protecting genuine owner occupancies, improving tax fairness, and preventing properties from being locked off the market. The government stressed that this was a listening session, however, and no final rates or thresholds were decided.
Let's talk about property tax, or sometimes described as a real estate ownership tax, or otherwise holding tax sometimes, the tax you pay for simply owning a piece of real estate. What have the experts said about increasing property taxes or ownership taxes? And what did they say should be appropriate levels for these property slash ownership taxes?
So there was fairly broad support among the panelists for strengthening property taxes, but there was no agreement on one appropriate numerical level. Some experts said that Korea's effective property tax rate remains too low to discourage speculative ownership, and called for gradual increases in both property tax and the comprehensive real estate property tax. One panelist proposed raising the fair market value ratio used for the comprehensive real estate property tax from the current 60% to around 80%. Another argued that the effective rate for ultra-high value homes should eventually rise to at least 1% of the home value. Others warned that a rapid increase could cause owners to hold on to their properties rather than sell, reduce rental supply, or pass the additional tax burden onto tenants through higher rents. There was more agreement on the structure than on the rate. Many participants favored taxing owners according to the combined value of their properties rather than simply the number of homes they own. They also supported distinguishing between homes that are actually occupied by their owners and homes held primarily as investments.
So a lot to unpack there. So raising the ownership tax to 1% could mean a lot of money, but some panelists there that you mentioned warned that a rapid increase there could cause owners to pass on that increased tax to tenants in the form of rents and perhaps chunzae systems, which is, of course, Korea's unique rental system in which tenants pay a large deposit and pay no rent. And then there is, of course, the issue of capital gains taxes. What were the views on capital gains taxes at the debate?
Yeah, so that was perhaps the most important issue at hand at the debate today. So under the current system, an eligible single homeowner can receive a deduction of up to 40% based on the period of ownership and another 40% based on the period of actual residence. This means that the total reduction can reach 80%. The controversy is that a person can receive the ownership-based portion even without living there. Critics say this encourages people to retain one very expensive home and gives the largest benefits to owners of homes that have generated very large capital gains. Many panelists, therefore, proposed reducing or abolishing the deduction based purely on ownership and shifting the benefit toward actual residence. Some also proposed limiting the deduction for ultra-high value homes or for properties producing exceptionally large capital gains. At the same time, they warned that reducing the deduction without prior warning could create a lock-in effect, as owners may decide not to sell because of the higher tax bill. Proposals to reduce that risk included introducing a transition period, temporarily offering favorable treatment for properties sold within a set period of time, or linking capital gains tax relief to the amount of holding property tax already paid.
During a cabinet meeting Tuesday, President Lee asked on a live YouTube stream for opinions about what price level would qualify as the threshold for being classified as, quote, ultra-high value homes. The threshold being discussed among government officials ranged from 3 billion won, that's a billion with a B, to 5 billion won. And for listeners outside Korea, 1 billion won equals around 675,000 U.S. dollars. So the 3 billion to 5 billion range would mean around 2 million to 3.3 million U.S. dollars. President Lee asked people who were at this debate what threshold should be considered the appropriate threshold, asking people to select among options 1 billion, 2 billion, and 3 billion won. The respondents leaned towards the higher numbers, and President Lee joked about it a few times during this debate. But Mr. Shim, was there a heated discussion about this particular topic at this week's debates?
It was discussed, but it was not the most heated or decisive part of the debate. The moderator presented several possible thresholds, including market prices of 2 billion, 3 billion, 5 billion, and even 10 billion. Individual panelists suggested figures such as 4 or 5, while another suggested looking at the most expensive 0.1% of homes rather than setting a fixed amount. The more fundamental question, however, in recent weeks has been whether a separate threshold is needed at all. Some experts have said that if the tax system is changed from a home count basis to a progressive value-based system, owners of more expensive properties would automatically pay more. If deductions for actual residents were also capped, ultra-high-value homes could face a heavier burden without creating a separate legal category for them or changing the threshold. There are also technical questions. The government must decide whether the threshold would be based on the market price or the government-assessed value, or in the case of capital gains tax, the size of the actual gain. For that reason, the specific figure of 3 billion or 5 billion won was treated as secondary to the overall design of the tax system, which was the top main theme of the debate today.
Based on Thursday's debate, what is the real estate tax reform initiative expected to look like?
Based on Thursday's debate, the reform is likely to have two major components. The first is a revision of property taxes. The government may move toward taxing properties according to their combined value rather than the number of homes they own, people own. It may also raise the burden on non-resident owners of expensive homes by adjusting the fair market value ratio or reducing existing deductions. Genuine owner-occupiers could continue to receive some protection. The second is a redesign of the special long-term holding deduction under the capital gains tax. The most likely direction would be to reduce benefits based simply on ownership and place greater weight on the period of actual residence. Benefits for ultra-high-value homes or homes generating very large capital gains may also be capped. The overall policy direction appears to be higher taxation at the owning stage, combined with measures to prevent excessive capital gains taxation from discouraging sales. However, the specific rates, deduction limits, threshold, and implementation dates remain undecided. The government plans to reflect the debate in its tax reform package after the president-moderated discussion on July 23rd.
Another contentious issue discussed during this week's debates was loan regulations, that is, mortgage regulations. What were the main points of contention about this particular topic?
The central disagreement was how to control household debt and speculative demand without preventing young people and genuine first-time buyers from purchasing homes. Supporters of easing the rules argued that young people and first-time buyers should receive targeted exemptions from loan-to-value and debt service restrictions. They said uniform restrictions are unfair to people who do not already own the property. Opponents, however, warned that simply allowing young people to borrow more could increase both household debt and housing prices. In other words, the benefit could ultimately go to existing homeowners rather than younger buyers. Jeonse loans were another major issue. Some experts argued that support should be expanded for tenants and households without homes. Others said excessive Jeonse lending can push up deposits, support gap investment, and indirectly increase sale prices. There was also debate on whether relocation loans for reconstruction and redevelopment projects should be eased. Supporters said tight limits are delaying projects and restricting future housing supply. Critics said special treatment for these for redevelopment association members would be unfair compared with the treatment for young or lower income borrowers. The likely compromise would be to maintain overall controls and household lending in the near term, while creating more carefully targeted exceptions for the first-time buyers. Vulnerable tenants and legitimate housing supply projects would be the beneficiaries in this compromise.
Several terms for listeners that might not be familiar. The loans here in Korea regarding real estate can touch on mortgage loans. Those are more traditional loans that are available outside Korea widely. There's, of course, the 전세 loans. 전세, again, is a system here in which tenants pay a very large deposit and do not pay monthly rents. And sometimes you have to take out loans because the 전세 deposit is just so huge. And then there are, of course, the loans regarding redevelopment projects that Mr. Shim just mentioned. These are loans given to people who must move out of their homes because their apartments are being demolished and then being rebuilt into brand new ones. So they need the loans to relocate, at least temporarily. President Lee Jae-myung will chair a public debate, which has been described as the National Grand Debate on Real Estate Policy, by government officials on Thursday of next week, which aims to cover the full range of related policies and the opinions regarding real estate taxes. Mr. Shim, what can we expect from next week's debate and what issues should we watch out for in the coming weeks?
So it'll bring together the arguments presented during this week's separate discussions on housing supply, finance, and taxation. The results are expected to help shape the tax reform package due around the end of July or early August. The biggest issue will probably be the balance between property taxes and transaction taxes. The key questions will be whether property taxes should rise, whether capital gains taxes should be adjusted to encourage owners to sell, and how sharply the government should distinguish between owner-occupied and non-resident properties. Another major issue will be whether the government provides loan exemptions for young people, first-time buyers, as we just as I just explained, and the last one would be the debate on supply. And the discussion is likely to focus on reconstruction and redevelopment regulations, financial support for housing projects, and measures to expand non-apartment housing, such as an office tower. The central tension will be whether easing regulations can accelerate supply without immediately increasing land and apartment prices. The political divide is also likely to become clearer. The government and the ruling party are expected to emphasize tax fairness, actual residence, and curbing speculative demand. The opposition is more likely to warn after the debate or the discussion that day that higher property taxes could affect ordinary single homeowners, create uncertainty, and repeat the problems of earlier tax-driven housing policies. It is also likely to place greater emphasis on deregulation and expanding supply. The most important thing to watch for is not necessarily whether the president announces a specific tax rate during the debate. It is which principles he prioritizes, whether it be higher property tax, lower transaction taxes, stronger protection for actual residents, targeted lending relief, or faster supply through deregulation. That choice will determine the shape of the measures announced in the following weeks.
That was Shim Seo-hyun, a reporter for News One, a wire service here in South Korea. Mr. Shim, thank you for your time today.
Thank you again for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index plunged 463.81 points, or 6.37% on Thursday to close at 6,820.6. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 37.59 points, or 4.53%, to close at 791.84. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets, handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
What's our first story?
Dong Guangping, a Chinese dissident that drifted aboard a small boat to Korea and was arrested in late May, received a suspension of indictment on charges of illegal entry into Korea.
So Dong Guangping entered the country on a boat. He was arrested for illegal entry into Korea. And Dong is, of course, a quite well-known figure here. What's the latest on this case in Korea?
So the State Prosecution Service announced Wednesday that the Seosan branch of the Daejeon District Prosecutor's Office decided to suspend the indictment against Dong last Friday. Authorities decided not to pursue the case given the exceptional circumstances surrounding Dong's offense. He was found drifting aboard a small motorized inflatable boat near an island off Taiwan County, South Chungcheong Province on May 25th. Spotted by local fishers, arrested by the Korea Coast Guard and then referred to prosecutors without detention, Dong revealed his intention to seek asylum and argued that he had not entered Korea simply to cross the border illegally, but to seek help and to get to Canada.
His political activism, of course, was probably not welcomed in his home country. I suspect that's why he came here in the first place. But what were his plans exactly, and why Canada, and why did authorities drop their case against him here in Korea?
Well, looking at the authorities' decisions, for one, Dong had already left Korea, so it's unlikely any sentence could be enforced. According to a report by the New York Times, Dong reunited with his wife and daughters in Toronto, Canada last month after leaving Korea. His family members had already settled there. Another major influencing factor, strong appeals from international organizations, including the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which submitted opinion letters expressing concern over imposing excessive criminal punishment for Dong's illegal entry.
Tell us more about Dong himself. What's his story?
So the man in his late 60s, Dong served as a police officer and soldier in China. After decades of servitude, he was dismissed in 1999 after signing a letter tied to the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. He has since become a prominent dissident and democracy activist in China. He was detained after attending a Tiananmen memorial event in 2014 and went on to face repeated imprisonment following a series of escapes and forced returns from Thailand, Taiwan, and Vietnam.
Wishing Mr. Dong safety and good wishes to his family as well. But let's now move on to our next story. What do you have, Dan?
Delivery robots. Not hard to spot them at work, roaming the streets here in Korea. It was decided in 2023 that the delivery bots on sidewalks or roads be classified as pedestrians.
I think I've seen a few of them. I haven't seen a lot of them, but I know what you're talking about. But obviously some serious questions to answer there, legal ones in this case, perhaps safety issues as well. But what were some of the issues raised by human pedestrians about delivery robots?
Well, they are tiny, classified as pedestrians, so you mostly see them moving along with other people. Well, the delivery robots are programmed to travel at about the same speed as a person walking. Everyone's walking speed is different, and often you'll see people having to walk around them or wait patiently behind these machines. Some people said in recent interviews that sometimes a robot malfunction or hesitate, halting traffic or even tripping people as they're fairly low to the ground. Even smaller miniaturized version of R2-D2, if you might want to picture Star Wars, they barely come up to an adult's waist level.
So these are small, so people can trip over them. They're difficult to predict in terms of movements. The next question, I guess, is do they pose risk to drivers?
Yes, it can be more dangerous for people behind the wheel. First of all, as we mentioned, they are small and sometimes human pedestrians miss them and stumble over them. So their visibility is even much lower for drivers, especially when it's dark or if it's raining.
Were there any prominent accidents involving delivery bots or vehicles?
Yes, there were. Just last month, there was an incident when the driver could not see the robot after hitting it, but heard a noise, then tried to move on, thinking maybe it was just a rock. Then the robot, instead of moving out of the way, remained still, leading to back-to-back fender benders. In 2024, a collision occurred in Songdo, Incheon, involving a jaywalking delivery robot. At the insurance claim stage, robots are classified simply as pedestrians, so it results in cases where fault is assigned in a way that disadvantages vehicle drivers.
So lots of problems to untangle there, one being jaywalking, not by human pedestrians, but robots. What has been the government's response to these issues?
Well, the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Resources is reviewing ways to improve the legal framework, including revising relevant laws in line with the robot era. Authorities will need to clearly establish clear-cut lines on responsibilities held in case of accidents, traffic accidents. With already some 340 government-approved delivery robots in operation out there and more to come with areas to operate set to expand, safety must be assured as continued issues and opposition to related programs by the human public could ultimately stunt the sector's growth.
Wishing for a swift resolution there, but shall we now turn to our final story?
Faker, arguably the biggest name in esports and one of the most decorated stars in the League of Legends history, is named a game ambassador for the Esports World Cup and Esports Nations Cup.
Sounds like a no-brainer on the part of any esports-related event to get Faker involved. Tell us more, Dan.
The Saudi-backed organizer said Thursday that Faker, real name Lee Sang-hyuk, will be their game ambassador through the year 2028. If you're wondering how big of a superstar one has to be to earn that part, the only other two that joins Faker in the Esports Foundation's as the Esports Foundation's ambassadors are football superstar Cristiano Ronaldo and chess grandmaster Magnus Carlsen.
Some big names there. What does a game ambassador exactly do?
They're looked to help promote a global competitive culture that spans traditional sport, competitive gaming, and esports. Faker will represent players across the foundation's international tournaments, athlete support programs, media activities, and leadership forums, and help strengthen ties among players, fans, and industry groups.
It must have been an easy decision for the organizers in selecting Faker, but tell us what specifically they said about the reasons for choosing Faker.
Well, the foundation officials say you can't talk about esports without mentioning Faker, and added that Faker is the defining athlete of competitive gaming, a champion whose excellence, discipline, and longevity have inspired an entire generation. Faker has competed for T1 for more than a decade, won 6 world championships and 10 titles in Korea's top league, the LCK. The Esports World Cup is taking place in Paris this year, first time it's being held outside of Saudi Arabia, where it launched in 2024. It started on July 6th and runs through August 23rd. The prize pool is a record high $75 million.
Wishing good luck to Faker, but that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's she going to think? I don't care what she thinks.
Yes.
I don't care what anyone thinks.
Yes.
I'm getting out of here.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, my Lord.
This is Broadway actor Hwang Joo-min. Now you're listening to KBS World Radio.
It's time now for our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we uncover hidden stories and experiences from around the country. Joining us this week is Aliza Duda from the Korea Heritage Agency. Welcome to Korea 24, Aliza.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and share the beauty of Korea's heritage with the listeners.
It's great to have you here, too. Since it's your first time joining us on Korea 24, let's start by getting to know you a little better. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners, please?
Of course. My name is Aliza. I'm from Germany, and I moved to Korea 4 years ago in September 2022. I discovered my interest for Korea and Korean culture in quite early in middle school, around 2008. So I studied Korean studies at Ruhr University Bochum in Germany, and also attended the Korean studies summer school at Kyujanggak Institute at Seoul National University. And after COVID, when the borders opened again, I finally was able to move to Seoul and started working as an artist here in Korea.
Artist. The world needs more people like you.
Thank you.
We've had explorers from Korea Heritage Agency on our show, and our listeners are quite familiar with what the agency is trying to promote. But since it's your first time on Korea 24, could you also tell us what you do as a global ambassador for the Korea Heritage Agency?
Of course. As you may already know, the Korea Heritage Agency promotes the value of Korea's national heritage through a wide range of programs and events and works to revitalize it for future generations. As an ambassador, I attend programs that are all about Korean heritage, Korean traditional arts, culture, and history. During these events, I take pictures and videos and share my thoughts through online content and media coverage, such as podcasts, writing articles, or on radio like today. So the ambassador are actively promoting Korean heritage and sharing it with the world in like multiple languages.
Thank you for your service, Lisa. But now to today's journey, where are you taking us today?
So today I'm taking you to an exhibition about Korean traditional crafts, the Gongdulim exhibition. It's a special joint exhibition by 12 workshops held at the exhibition hall Kyol at the second floor on the National Intangible Cultural Heritage Training Center. It's a very difficult word. Mm-hmm. Near Sonjungneung Station in Seoul. I've been there twice, once as a regular visitor and once for the official opening ceremony. And this exhibition starts exactly with that, with the artisans that keep Korean traditional crafts alive.
So the Gongdulim exhibition is being held at the second floor of the National Intangible Cultural Heritage Training Center. That is six words. That's in the Gangnam area at the Sonjungneung Station, to be exact. Tell us more about the exhibition itself, though, Elisa.
Yes. Gongdulim is an exhibition that focuses on the artisans, what it takes to create traditional pieces of art, and it invites visitors to reflect on the hard work behind each finished piece. The exhibition is divided into five sections. It begins with the beginning of the work, where you get a glimpse of the 12 workshops and their work tables. The crafts that are represented are embroidery, needlework, tray table making, musical instrument making, bow and arrow making, decorative knotting, metal engraving, calligraphic engraving, horsehair hat making, silver or gold inlaying, and ox horn inlaying.
Some old school Korean artisan work there. So what exactly can visitors see?
Visitors can see the behind the scenes of these crafts and the way the tools used to create those artworks have been molded themselves to the shape of the artisan's hand through like decades of use. And only after experiencing the perspective of the people behind the artworks, you're able to actually see the artworks. And by then, you naturally start paying closer attention to the details of the work, like the fine veins and the exquisite joints that have been created over so many hours of craftsmanship.
Fascinating. It shows the artworks and also focuses on the artisans behind the works. You mentioned embroidery, needlework, tray table making, horsehair hat making, and inlaying technique. So I'm thinking of needles, hammers, knives. Are these tools displayed as well?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. You can see many of those tools in the exhibition as well. But what I found interesting is that these are things we don't usually think about when we look at a finished art piece. What kind of needle or tool the artisan used, or how an embroidery work table differs from a needlework work table. Because they sound similar, but when you look closer, you can see that even in the preparation phase, it differs already.
I can imagine myself thinking in a similar light. Lisa, if you had to describe the artworks to someone who has never seen Korean traditional crafts before, what would you say were the art pieces that are most memorable to you?
The first art piece that comes to mind is one of the embroidery pieces. So I love embroidery. There is a folding screen in the exhibit with four panels, and each panel is decorated with embroidered images of a nature scene. In the past, these folding screens were used to conceal or partition a space to serve as a decorative backdrop in the interior of ritual halls or royal palaces. And this piece is a reproduction of the national folklore cultural heritage called Folding Screen Embroidered with Grass and Insects, which is estimated to have been made during the mid-Joseon period. It combines the original works by Shin Sam-dang called Paintings of Grass and Insects with embroidery. So you can see butterflies, bees, different types of flowers and rocks. And it looks like a painting. And when I was standing in front of the screen, I actually asked myself, do I need glasses? Because I was already so close to it, but I could barely see any stitches. So I pulled out my phone and took a video of the butterflies with like 10 times zoom. And even then, the stitches were so perfect and so tiny that it looks like brush strokes.
Wow, that sounds beautiful and very delicate. Shin Sam-dang is, of course, known for being on the 50,001 bill for most of us here in Korea. She's on the bill, though, because, at least in part, she was a very talented artist, as you just described. The 50,001 bill includes some of her wonderful artwork. Lisa, tell us about any other meaningful works that you might want to share.
The second artwork I would choose, to be honest, it's a bit difficult to only choose two. Mm-hmm. Many people interested in Korean culture and heritage may be familiar with the gat, the traditional Korean horsehair hat that was often used to reflect the social status of the nobility. Mm-hmm. Some people are surprised to learn that the gat is made with materials such as horsehair and bamboo, and not a thin type of metal, what most people think. But for me, what really surprised me was the craft of oxhorn inlaying. Before visiting, I have seen these finished pieces before, but I had simply assumed it was like something similar to shell inlaying, like mother of pearl crafts. And then when I visited, in the first section of the exhibition, I saw the oxhorn itself, and I wondered, what would they use it for? And then later in the third section, where the representative works are displayed, I saw the box decorated with oxhorn inlaying and remember thinking, wait, that's oxhorn?
I think many modern Koreans would agree with your thoughts. So what exactly happens with the oxhorn?
So it involves flattening highly transparent oxhorn into paper-thin sheets and decorating the reverse side with various decorative motifs painted in vivid tanjong pigments. The decorated horn sheets are then attached to a plain wooden core, while the remaining exposed surface, including the interior and the frameworks, are finished with lacquer. So it's kind of similar to mother of pearl crafts. And because the materials were rare and the production process is highly intricate, crafts using oxhorn were produced only in very limited quantities and were mainly used as luxury items or treasured possessions by the aristocratic class.
Few people would guess that's what happens. I also found interesting your notes on the kat, the traditional headgear for Korean nobility. I was, of course, vaguely aware that they were made of animal hair, but now that you mention it, horsehair makes a lot of sense. The kat, again, is, of course, also featured on the K-pop Demon Hunters show, where the boy group is wearing them as part of their stage outfits. Maybe this could spark interest among younger generations to learn how to make the kat themselves and appreciate the hard work behind the craft. What's displayed in the last part of the exhibition, though?
That would be wonderful, I agree. And then maybe in the future we will have to get to hear more stories of more artisans and their crafts. In the last part, after visitors see the finished works, the exhibition moves into a section called The Language of Artisans, where you get to know the stories of the artisans themselves in a short film. These stories capture the sincere thoughts and ideas of the artisans who work at these intangible heritage transmission sites, ranging from the meaning of their work to their momentary concerns. While following the words that reflect the working life of the artisans, we can appreciate the value and the spirit of precious traditions that live on all around us. And before leaving, there's a stamp zone, where visitors can make a bookmark by stamping patterns that symbolize the 12 workshops. And you can choose your favorite piece of the exhibition and create a small artwork yourself. And it's a nice reminder in daily life that masterpieces take time to create.
Alisa, for listeners who want to check it out for themselves, please give us the practical details.
Yes, of course. The exhibition Gwangdulim is open to visit now until the 21st of August at the National Intangible Cultural Heritage Training Center, located near the subway station Sonjungneung in Gangnam, Seoul. It's right in front of exit 3, so you can't miss it. The exhibition is open Monday to Sunday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. No tickets needed, just go to the second floor and enjoy the free exhibition. English explanations are displayed throughout the exhibition, so don't worry if you don't speak Korean.
Listeners can check out Aliza's photos on our Instagram account, KBS at KBS underscore Korea 24. That was KBS underscore Korea 24. And that was Aliza Duda from the Korea Heritage Agency introducing us to the Gongdeurim exhibition being held at the, again, this is six words, National Intangible Cultural Heritage Training Center at Seonjeongneung Station Exit 3. Aliza, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's edition of Korea 24. Just a reminder, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Goodbye.
사랑하는 사람 정호승.
The people I love by 정호승.
나는 그늘이 없는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 그늘을 사랑하지 않는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 한 그루 나무의 그늘이 된 사람을 사랑한다.
I do not love people who have no shadows. I do not love people who do not love shadows. I love people who have become the shade beneath a tree.
햇빛도 그늘이 있어야 맑고 눈이 부시다. 나무 그늘에 앉아 나뭇잎 사이로 반짝이는 햇살을 바라보면 세상은 그 얼마나 아름다운가.
Sunlight too needs shade to shine bright and dazzle the eyes. Sitting in the shade of a tree and watching the sunlight sparkling between the leaves, how beautiful the world is then.
눈물이 없는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 눈물을 사랑하지 않는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 한 방울 눈물이 든 사람을 사랑한다.
I do not love people who have no tears. I do not love people who do not love tears. I love people who have become one teardrop.
기쁨도 눈물이 없으면 기쁨이 아니다. 사랑도 눈물 없는 사랑이 어디 있는가? 나무 그늘에 앉아 다른 사람의 눈물을 닦아주는 사람의 모습은 그 얼마나 고요한 아름다움인가.
Joy too is no joy without tears. And is there ever love without tears? The sight of someone sitting in the shade of a tree, wiping away another's tears. What serene beauty that is.
You've listened to Korean poet Jung Ho Sung's 내가 사랑하는 사람, The People I Love, read by An Jae-woo and translated by Brother Anthony of Tays and Son Jae. KBS World Radio brings the beauty of Korean poetry to the world.
Mm-hmm.